Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. Austin, you wrote an article, I think it was last week on, or maybe the week before, on the Nigerian mall shootings.
Kenyan mall shootings.
Oh, the Kenyan mall shootings. Yeah, I don't know why I said Nigeria.
Well, I know exactly what you did. It was sub-Saharan Africa, and you were dealing with Islamist terror attacks. And as Jim writes, every 10 days on the situation in Nigeria. So it's different tribes, some different local issues, but in a broad sense, you've got a similar kind of conflict.
Right. Well, the mall shootings were perpetrated by literally an affiliate of Al-Qaeda called Al-Shabaab. Who is this group for those of our listeners that may not have heard of Al-Shabaab before?
Well, this is something that we've heavily on the site. Jim, do you want to go ahead and take it? Islamic courts and give the background on Al-Shabaab?
The Somalia has never really been united, only by the colonial powers, and even there, Italy and Britain sort of split the country, and France is also involved, Djibouti. When the colonial powers left in the 60s, they left one of those rare times, it's happened before, but briefly, where Somalia was united. It didn't last. By 1990, the clan, or tribe, they call them clans, rivalries tore the country apart. And they've been without government ever since. Now, the Somalis, they are not really comfortable with all this anarchy, even though that's a fairly natural state, you know, in what is called Somalia, especially since during the colonial period, nobody liked the colonial powers, but they didn't keep the peace. You know, it's the old problem the Romans had. Nobody likes us, but hey, you know, the caravans run on time. The solution to general unrest in Somalia has historically been religion-based. In other words, the clerics, who are often among the tribal elder, the clan elders, so to speak, who run the clans, or try to anyway. They established a movement called the Islamic courts. And what they basically did was they organized clan militias whose only purpose was to install a little law and order. I mean, literally, people couldn't go travel to go to the market. They couldn't go out, send the kids out to watch the herds. You just couldn't live, you know, with all the banditry and raiding and what have you, which is, again, is a Somali custom that goes back centuries. The Islamic courts, again, in a very Somali fashion, they fractured. And there was a moderate group, you know, who basically, we just want law and order, you know, nothing else. And then there was another bunch that were more hardcore, were basically influenced by the spread of Saudi-sponsored Wahhabism, fundamentalist Islam. Again, which is an old problem in Islam. It's been a problem for over 1,000 years. Every couple generations, some people decide, I'm more Islamic than thou, and I'll kill you if you don't agree with me. I mean, literally, that's what happens again and again. So, all of a sudden, the Islamic courts became part of the problem, not part of the solution. There are several radical factions, but the strongest or most violent one was Al-Shabaab, which means the youth. Again, troublesome teenagers are an old problem. And you give them AK-47s and they really get out of control, which is precisely what happened in Somalia. Al-Shabaab then split. You see a pattern here, right? Basically what you had was the Somalia nationalist faction who said, look, we just want to use our religious fanaticism to bring peace to Somalia. Because people were really tired. I mean, over 20 years of chaos, actually more close to 30 years, because during the 80s, there was a lot of infighting, and it got worse and worse until the country just fell apart. So you had the nationalists, and then you had the foreigners. because when Al-Shabaab got started, they were not affiliated with Al-Qaeda initially, but they did basically tell, you know, foreign Islamic radicals that, hey, you know, come to Somalia. You know, you'll find a friendly, if rather violent, you know, atmosphere to operate in. After 2007, the defeat of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and then earlier, they basically were crushed, you know, after 2001, 2002, 2003, in Afghanistan, there were a lot of Islamic militants looking for a new sanctuary. And, they basically found it in Somalia. So year by year, you had more and more of these basically veteran Islamic radicals coming to Somalia and making the internationalist faction, the foreign faction of Al-Shabaab, stronger and stronger. Well, in the last 2 years, Al-Shabaab suffered many defeats because basically the rest of the country said, you know, enough with the religious fanaticism. It's not making things better. This brought in African Union peacekeepers, and United States was sending in assistance, not many people. There was a CIA base, literally, you know, Mogadishu, but that was about it, and some UAVs going overhead. But we had our Black Hawk Down incident back in, what, 93, 94, and we didn't know there was no enthusiasm within the United States for sending any more troops in there. So Al-Shabaab basically was pummeled in the last 2 years. They lost control of, for several years, they controlled a big chunk of Mogadishu and many of the other major towns in Somalia. By the way, in the midst of all this, most of northern Somalia split off as independent and somewhat peaceful statelets, as we call them. Nobody really recognizes them, called Puntland and Somaliland. So, you know, basically we're only talking about two-thirds of Somalia.
Jim,
Al-Shabaab, yeah.
Ethiopia recognizes the Somaliland Republic. They're the only one.
Yeah, but I mean, that's local politics. Now, Al-Shabaab says what really got them going was Ethiopia invading. And they did. They came in 07 and basically helped to, not 07, but anyway, they came in 4 or 5 years ago and basically helped to basically put down Al-Shabaab, who by everybody's count was getting too strong. The United States apparently paid for some of that. And Ethiopia had another reason for getting involved, because Al-Shabaab was aiding the rebels in the Ogaden, which is the province of Ethiopia right next to Somalia. And this province is primarily ethnic Somalis. Now, Ethiopia has controlled it for a long, long time because Ethiopia is organized, and they pretty much stay organized. They are one of the few countries, if not the only one, in sub-Saharan Africa, which was never colonized. The Italians occupied them for a couple of years, you know, before World War II, but that didn't last. And actually, Italy suffered one of its most ignominious defeats at the hands of a much less well-equipped Ethiopian army, something Ethiopians are quite proud of. Anyway, be that as it may, Al-Shabaab said, we're basically fighting to keep Somalia free of our ancient enemy, the Ethiopians. But basically, it was all about turning Somalia and, you know, as much territory as they could into an Islamic, you know, dictatorship, which really nobody was interested in. So what happened this year was there was a coup within Al-Shabaab, and most of the key nationalist Al-Shabaab leaders were either killed or basically driven into exile, you know, or quit, you know. So now the international faction, which is basically Al-Qaeda oriented, they want to go outside of Somalia to basically commit their terrorist acts. They were running the show, what was left of it. By the way, in the last 2 years, Al-Shabaab did officially become a franchise, as it were, of Al-Qaeda. Again, that was to appease the internationalist faction. But now they are basically completely in that. And what's happened is very curious. This doesn't get much play in the news. Actually, some of it's quite recent. The attack in Nairobi in the mall on the 21st, which went on for about 3 days, was first described. Now, you'll notice, I think people probably recognize, we didn't cover a lot of the dramatic stories, you know, the white widow and you know, English-speaking terrorists, et cetera, the all sorts of plots and schemes. No, now, just recently, in the last maybe 24 hours, they got a hold of the security camera footage. I was waiting for that because it's a mall, a modern mall. You got security cameras all over the place. But there was apparently not much access to that, you know, when the attackers went in. Originally, it was described as 15 or so al-Shabaab. Well, the only thing they've been able to find in the security camera footage so far is 4 armed men coming into the mall, shooting their way in, and then just going down the hallways of the mall, killing anybody they can spot. Well, actually, they were seen going through some drill, asking people if they were Muslim, asking a few questions about Islam. And those who can answer went on their way, and anyone else, you know, is considered fair game and gunned down. Now, what was interesting about all this, a few days ago, Kenya declared them all, you know, terrorist free. Now, the place was burned up. Several floors had collapsed because the army used explosives to get at what they considered the last group of al-Shabaab gunmen. But they have no bodies. The military claim to have killed 5 of the al-Shabaab terrorists, but they have no bodies. Now, there is rubble from the collapsed part. There may indeed be bodies. They haven't identified possibly all the civilian dead. They do suspect that some or maybe all of the al-Shabaab gunmen basically changed into other civilian clothes and came out, you know, as civilians. Apparently, they just let all those people go. They didn't make, you know, sure everybody was who they were and not terrorists. And 3 policemen and 3 soldiers were killed in the fighting. Now, what I suspect and what was written in strategy page today was that the people, some of those friendly casualties, deaths, may have been friendly fire. It may be difficult to find out because, you know, again, they have to, if they, all the, in four, the 4 known invaders, they were using AK-47s and, some of the soldiers were not, they can just basically identify what killed, you know, the dead soldiers and policemen and find out, you know, if indeed it was friendly fire. But that's quite possible right now. The other thing is, in this, the same time, there were 2 small attacks on the border, on border towns in Kenya up north. One involved 1 guy with a gun and a couple hand grenades, came in, threw a couple grenades, fired, killed 1 person, I think, and then ran away. The other attack involved apparently 2 attackers who did the same thing, you know, bang, 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 couple grenades, and then got out of Dodge. But nothing has been happening with al-Shabaab for the last 2 weeks in Somalia. So you have what is quite possibly only 6 or less than 10 armed al-Shabaab fighters causing all this mayhem. And at the same time, nothing happening in Somalia for, you know, 2 weeks and what have you, which some analysts, including this one, are wondering if this is the sort of like the last, the last attempt, you know, to make it big. Because one of the big problems al-Shabaab is having by losing control of Mogadishu or parts of Mogadishu, and especially by recently in the last, I mean, last year, losing control of the other major port in Somalia, Kismayo, in the south, they've lost most of their income. Because basically they taxed every area they controlled, and they've lost the market towns, they've lost, they still occupy some villages and some small places, but no place where they can generate any money. And apparently they were making quite a bit of money. The latest accusation was that they were a conduit for the illegal ivory trade. In other words, if you wanted to get your ivory out of Africa, get it to Somalia, and, you know, there are people there who can do business and make it happen, basically by smuggling it out via Kismayo. So they lost all that money. And a lot of people working for al-Shabaab, a lot of these government were not volunteers. They had to be paid. They had to be supplied. And, of course, some of the senior people had families that had to be taken care of and what have you. They had a payroll. They had regular expenses. Most of this is gone. Now, the only other source of income is from the wealthy Arabs in the Gulf states, who have been a problem for years by donating to charities which they knew or were generally known to be conduits to Arab terrorist organizations or Islamic terrorist organizations. Now, in the last 5 or 6 years, especially Saudi Arabia has finally gotten on board with clamping down on this, but now they know that as strenuous as those efforts have been, the money is still getting to terrorist organizations. We know that because, again, we capture documents, we intercept messages, et cetera, you know, the usual means. So they know the money's still getting in there, out there. And al-Shabaab knows this too, but the only way you get money from these donors is to get in the news, which is exactly what they've done. So it's good news and bad news. You know, the bad news is they've killed over 60 people in the mall, most of them, you know, innocent civilians. The good news is this is their last hurrah, because apparently there's not much else left going on with al-Shabaab. So this may be the end. But then again, the four people who shot up the mall, they have escaped, which is, I guess, more bad news. But what can you do? You can take what you can get in this business.
Austin, why was Kenya picked as the target?
Well, Kenya's been a target for a long time, Dan. You remember 1998, what was it, August 7th, I think, was the date of the attacks on the two U.S. embassies in East Africa, one in Dar es Salaam. Tanzania, and the one in Nairobi. And the one in Nairobi was the most devastating of them. Look, I've done a couple of columns on this, and you'll see that some of what I'm about to say in some of the Ethiopia reports, when we were focusing more on some things when Kenya was in the operating on its own in southern Somalia, not part of AMISOM, but moving towards the port of Kismayo. So you can type that within the last 2 years. But look, there's a divide, and it's really a zone, Dan, that runs across Africa. And it's sometimes called the fault line, the Muslim-Christian fault line. There's more to it than that. But it's where the expansionist Muslim tribes kind of reached a limit in with southern Africa, animus mostly at the time. And that's one thing when you brought up, you mentioned Nigeria, you know, you confused West with East Africa, but then not really a confusion on that fault line. That fault line drifts across the middle of the continent. And I'll just give a personal insight into this. I've spent time in Kenya and Uganda and northwestern Uganda. And you are when you're in the town of Nebbi, there's a mosque there in the town of Nebbi. But if you go about 40 to 50 kilometers north, you get into what is more Muslim territory. So there's somewhere in there is part of this fault line. Just remember that there are a lot of Christians and animists that live in South Sudan, and that is north of Uganda. Kenya's been under attack. Kenya has it's an old war for Kenya in many ways. Now, I mentioned Kismayo a minute ago. When the spokesman for al-Shabaab, when the mall attack was going on, mall siege, I said that, you know, this was a payback for Kenya's invasion of southern Somalia. And the port of Kismayo, and Jim was talking a minute ago about that being the center of operations for al-Shabaab and the center of where they, their financial center as well for smuggling operations and also getting arms, weapons, money, what else, coming in from the Arabian Peninsula. The Kenyans took that in an attack last September, I believe it was, September of, not last September, but a year ago, in 2012. And that time frame. It was kind of a slow encirclement, and then they pulled off an amphibious attack, among other things, as part of the final seizure of the city. The Kenyans, to their credit, one of the reasons they said they were taking so long is that they were trying to negotiate with all of these tribes, clans, as Jim said, but tribes in southern Somalia, because they didn't want the continuing chaos. Al-Shabaab thrives on chaos. The armed youth that Jim talks about thrive on our armed chaos. So they were trying to negotiate a political deal, and that takes a lot of negotiation with every single one of these little villages and clan leaders. Now, I followed this at a distance, but I will say over about a 15-month period, Dan, I read a dozen articles talking about, and a couple of them in depth, about the negotiations that the Kenyan government, primarily the Kenyan military, because they were the guys on the ground, was conducting with these clans and tribes around Kismayo and through an area that's called Jubaland. There's a river in there, the Juba, actually, and there's some accusations, too, on the part of the Somalis that Kenya actually favors a separatist Jubaland. Jim was already talking about Puntland and Somaliland Republic in the north, to act as a buffer state between it and Mogadishu. Could be. There are Kenyans that talk about it as well, but that doesn't appear to be in the cards. That said, the successful seizure of Kismayo and the successful negotiations leave this may fit in and add some other buttress some of the things Jim was saying about the Al-Shabaab being, I don't think they're defeated, but in an desperate situation and using this attack as a sensational act to say, you know, we're still around. But all those components, the success of Kenyan military forces and Kenyan diplomacy in Somalia, understand I say comparative success, not an absolute success, makes Kenya ripe for an attack. Understand Uganda had a huge attack by Al-Shabaab. Jim, wasn't that in July of 2010? I think it was. So they went after Uganda Uganda has troops in AMISOM, the African Union peacekeeping mission in Somalia. So those were the sensible ones. I want to add a couple of things, though, about the number of Maul attackers. The Kenyans said after, in the last few days of the battle, that they had arrested, and I remember the figure 11, well, a couple of reports said 10, but 11 people that had left the Mall or were in the Mall area, or that they were, a couple of them they were certain had been involved in the attack. So I think we need to wait and see how that filters out. They may have captured some of these people and arrested them as they tried to sneak out, because one of the articles too had one of the fellows they caught had an AK-47 clip, and he was trying to hide in his pants. How did he get that? So if that pans out, he was probably one of the people arrested. I'm not sure if that was the case, but it was included in that particular story. So we may have seen, maybe there's only four on camera, and I read that same report. It looks to me, given the resistance that was put up, that it was more than four people. But we'll certainly know more as the investigation proceeds.
Jim, now there was reported in the news that there may have been an American connection with this attack, that there might have been members of Al-Shabaab that were former or current citizens of the United States that were part of the attack. What became of that? Was that substantiated?
All of it was speculation. Most of the stuff you're going to hear coming out in the immediate aftermath or while these attacks are going on is speculation. I spent many years as a TV pundit And I basically eventually gave it up because they're more interested in instant, you know, headlines than in the insightful, you know, analysis of what was going on. I mean, let's face it, the analysis can be a little, you know, blah. The truth usually is. Whereas if you invent something and make it sound reasonably, you know, accurate, bingo, you know, you've got more eyeballs. So that's why in strategy page you don't see us chasing that stuff because 90% of it turns out to be, you know, nonsense. So we don't follow, we just eliminate that phase entirely. That's why I'm saying, you know, I was waiting for the security cameras in there. Either that or somebody saying, oh, these attackers were clever. They went right for the security office and destroyed all of the, you know, the servers, you know, holding the security footage, as it were. Apparently they did not. Again, as Austin said, it will all come out. I mean, they're sifting, they're trying to identify all the dead people. They've arrested dozens of people. And that's a problem with the, with Kenya. Only a small percentage, some 5%, you know, of the population is Muslim, mostly around along the coast and up in the north near Somalia. They're basically the people who came in as traders and, you know, moved in their families, et cetera, et cetera. They're a minuscule part of the population and they stand out. That's one reason why they've had problems. Al-Shabaab has had problems carrying out these attacks deep into Africa because as Austin was pointing out, you know, there's the religion line, the green line, as we tend to call it. When the Muslims, especially, you know, angry-looking young Muslim men get below that line, they stand out, you know, very sharply. And what's made life really difficult for Islamic terrorists is cell phones. And they have become, you know, in the last decade, they have revolutionized, you know, African society, you know, basically society in many parts of the world, including Iraq and Afghanistan. Because once people have those cell phones and they have police who are reasonably, you know, certain to act on a hot tip, they will get hot tips. And this is, and again, this story isn't covered much, but, you know, from all the sources I'm hearing on the ground, as were people inside these countries, the locals are very into, you know, dealing with the terrorism problem with, you know, their cell phone. And they're very effective. And Al-Qaeda, again, they found documents. Some of these were revealed journalists got their hands on some of these Al-Qaeda training documents in Mali. Basically saying, you know, stay away from areas where you have people who don't like us and they have cell phones because you will get rumbled, baby. And, you know, that's it. Lights out. The terrorists, again, went to Nairobi because there's a significant Muslim population which they can hide in. And that's made the Muslims down there very nervous, again, which works against Al-Qaeda and other Islamic terrorists because, again, in the 2001 attacks in the United States, one of the things they uncovered was advice to the hijackers was stay away from American Muslims because many of them will turn you in. You know, many of them were rah-rah about, you know, Islamic radicalism and what have you. Strike a blow for us. But there were too many American Muslims who would basically pick up their cell phone and call the FBI. So this has been a problem with Al-Qaeda for a long time. And now, much to their, you know, displeasure, it's a problem in areas where they used to be safe because there was no real reliable telephone service. So this is keeping them out. And this is why we're probably going to get once the investigation is complete, which will unravel, you know, be revealed gradually over the next few weeks, we'll find out all the details of how many shooters there were in there, whether or not any were captured coming out, or it was just some guy who saw a magazine. It might have been an empty AK-47. Oh, a souvenir. Bingo.
Oh, Jim, it could well have been. The thing is, though, you know, looking at it was a very cool and responsible wire service report, and you know they had the police said that they found that on him, and they detained this man.
Well, I don't doubt it, but the devil is in the details.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
Was the guy who was caught? Did he have any background? I mean, they can do background checks.
You know,
they
can quickly
determine if a guy is a local Muslim or a Somali. He admits that they have a problem on the border with corruption. You know, the border guards have gotten accustomed to taking bribes to let anybody in, usually as smugglers, but occasionally as Islamic terrorists. the border guards, the corrupt border guards don't really make a distinction. Of course, now they may, so things will tighten up for a while. But the thing is, the truth will come out. We just can't have it immediately. I'm sorry, that just can't be done, as hard as we try.
Well, Jim, you're frustrating the sensationalist media when you do that. But actually, you've been doing that for about 30 years. I've watched that. Sorry.
Right. Yeah, I know. They told me. It used to be a game. For a long time, I did it because they knew what I was out there for, and I knew what they were looking for. I mean, one of the classic situations, I'll never forget, it was a guy, a producer I'd worked for years. And it was during the millennium, around 1999, and it was at the Hannity and Combs show. I distinctly remember. And we were doing a millennium piece, you know, what's going to happen. And they wanted me to talk about, you know, terrorists and chemical weapons. And the guy, he puts his hand on my shoulder, just you know, going on the set. He says, "Scare them, Jim." And he wasn't talking about Hannity and Combs. He was talking about the audience. Of course, I did my best to amuse people. I mean, to tell, look, the truth is, blah, blah, blah. And of course, I was more accurate than any of the other pundits, because how many incidents of terrorists using chemical weapons have we seen, you know, in the last 13 years? But that is not news. So you're right, Boston. You know, the mainstream media won't touch us because it's they go out of business if they do. We, on the other hand, are a very low budget, you know, operation, and we can afford to basically tell it as it is.
Right. Now, Austin, there was an American connection with al-Shabaab until they murdered him within the last year, correct? One of their leaders had been,
yeah,
been a...
That was the rap.
He's from my expatriate Somali community in, I'm going to get the state wrong. I was going to say Michigan, but it may be Minnesota. That's a guy.
Yeah.
Is that right, Jim? Is that the fellow we're talking about?
The thing is, what was interesting about this guy was what got him on the hit list, as it were, was that he came out on the internet, which he was familiar with, and that's why he made his bones. He was their propaganda minister, as it were, accusing the internationalist al-Shabaab leader, the guy who's currently in charge, of corruption, pointing out that while most of the al-Shabaab men were basically just getting by, and, you know, this guy was living large. And this is what got him killed more than anything else.
Right. Well, it looks like it'll be, hopefully we won't hear much from these guys anymore, or else they'll try to make another big bang so that they can get more followers.
Let me give you one word of warning. I saw this within the last 2 days. Of course, a spokesman is just like a fax machine. That al-Shabaab has threatened Kenya with other attacks such as that. But then again, it could all be propaganda. Jim's got some very good reasons for his the line of analysis that he offered today. He does. So
now, how effective, Jim, is Kenya's own Secret Service in ferreting this type of stuff out?
They're good, Jim? But the country suffers a lot from corruption. This is always getting to the.
So it's like any place else in Africa.
They're confident. Okay. Yeah, when they're good,
well,
they're very good.
We'll
and basically what they did was they invited in help.
Okay.
Well, Dan, I think it's about time to sign off. I keep losing you and Jim on the connection. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like our internet connection is fritzing out. But we'll talk to you guys next time.
Cyber gods.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll see
you guys. Bye.
Bye.